This show is part of the Electric Agora network of podcasts.
Dr. Bruce Jens, good to see you.
Great to be here.
Let me introduce the show real quick. And we're going to be talking about a whole bunch of stuff, but really kind of your interest in African philosophy and then how that leads to the idea of philosophy as an embodied, embedded, enacted, extended project. So we'll explain all that and what that means. But this is the SOFIA program, part of the Electric Agora and the Electric Agora podcast network. I'm Kevin Curry Knight, your host, a teaching associate professor at East Carolina University, and you are Bruce Jens. Can you give us just a brief introduction?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am at University of Central Florida. I am in the philosophy department. I'm also the co-director of a Center of Humanities and Digital Research, so work in digital humanities as well, and a core faculty member in the Text and Technology PhD program here as well. I am originally Canadian, taught in Canada before I came to the U.S. I have also taught in Kenya. I've taught in South Africa. You know, my areas of work tend to cluster around really issues around place and space in a wide range of meanings of that term. How we build places, how we lose them, how we yearn for them, you know, how we interact with them collectively. You know, what they look like in virtual space. So that led me in part to working in African philosophy, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. And it has led me to, you know, a host of thinkers, you know, both on the kind of philosophical kind of continental side of things, but also analytic and also historical as well, that don't really fit in either category. Yeah, so that's, you know, if you were to read the kind of stuff that I've written, it might look, you know, a little bit like, you know, where the heck did this come from? But there's a kind of a connection of everything to place and space for me that kind of nice. Provides a coherence, I guess.
Yeah, I feel the same about my own writing. I say everyone wants an interdisciplinary faculty member until they ask you at the interview what it is you do.
Right, exactly.
And then they don't want an interdisciplinary faculty member. Yeah. So whenever people ask me, like, what do you write? I say, what Kevin is interested in studies. That's my field.
Yeah, well, and you better have a good story to tell, you know, you better have a way of knitting all that stuff together and, you know, making sense out of it. And instead of it just seeming like totally scattershot, you know, I had this idea when I woke up this morning.
Yeah, for sure. So first question, just to kind of get us started. If you made a contract with yourself when you were 12 that says, from this day forth, I will only pursue what I am interested in today as a 12-year-old, whatever it is I want to be as a 12-year-old, this is what I will do.
Oh, my gosh.
What would that be?
Oh, my gosh. 12 years old. You know, here's the thing. I grew up in the prairies of Canada, Saskatchewan. I always felt a little bit out of place. And at 12, I guess I was starting to wonder why that was, you know, I guess, you know, I mean, I guess I tried a few things. I tried, you know, listening to music, for example, that, you know, there were certain kinds of music that if you were of that age on the Canadian prairies, this is what you listened to at that time. And I would say, yeah, that's cool. But how about this stuff over here? Like, that's kind of cool. I'd listen to, you know, ska or something like that. Ooh. That nobody listened to. You know, so if I was thinking as a 12-year-old of what I wanted to do, I think I would want to figure out why I was in the place I was by looking at everything but that, right?
Okay. It would involve. So you're already like, you already had the germinations of place.
There was a little
the
bit
importance
of place. And, you know, I mean... Or if not place, and not exactly placelessness either, you know, but a little bit of unease, a little bit of, you know, the you know, unheimlich, you know, uncanniness sensibility, like, you know, I belong yet I don't belong.
Right. You know? See, my answer is way stupider than yours. I would have been a white rapper. Well, I was the kid in class. I remember I was the kid in class who was like writing, you know, like tuning out the teacher, and I was writing.
Yeah.
Writing raps, and they were like, I'm stupendously bad, but they would just, I would write like four of them a day.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I tried to be the class clown sometimes too, but you know, I, I had accelerated in school. I took grades 4, 5, and 6 in 2 years, which put me out of my age group throughout high school. And so, you know, so the class clown thing kind of was both a protective mechanism and a, you know, a way of trying to, you know, fit in when I didn't really fit in. But that was another example of, you know, I don't belong in this place. Like, why am I here? Kind of thing.
Yeah. That's interesting. Well, then let's talk about moving into African philosophy and what that is and what that means for you. So at the risk of sounding gauche, you are a white Canadian.
Absolutely.
And I don't, for the benefit of our listeners, particularly audio only, Bruce is in fact a white Canadian who got into African philosophy. Was this before or after you started studying philosophy formally?
This was really after I had my PhD, but just after. So I've been doing African philosophy probably for 25 years now.
Okay. And how did that happen?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I guess there's several answers I can give. The kind of prosaic answer is, you know, my first wife was a development worker in Kenya. She was working often on the border of Kenya and Uganda, looking at food security issues and, you know, women's kind of empowerment, women's business sorts of things. And so I would be there, especially in the summers. You know, I would teach through the year and then I would go in the summer and, you know, I would just, I'd be their driver. I'd be their, you know, whatever they needed kind of thing. But at the same time, I was also going into Nairobi and just kind of showing up in the philosophy department and saying, hey there, I'm a philosopher too. And it just started talking to people. And so, you know, in a certain sense, that's what took me to Africa. And what got me into African philosophy was my old, sadly departed friend, Emmanuel Eze.
Whose book you recommended to me on social media, by the way, On Reason. I highly recommend this book. I read it and it was great.
I think it's a great book too. And it's the book that was published just after he passed away. And I think it would have gotten a lot more attention, had he been around. But so I ran into Emmanuel in the Nairobi department. He was making a tour of African philosophy departments basically. And, this was, I guess, 1990 or it might've been 94.
And I think he passed away in the mid, was it, I saw a YouTube video from, of him giving a lecture that was maybe, I want to say it was probably mid 90s. Looks like when it was recorded.
Yeah. Well, he actually passed away in 2008.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
So he was around that long. And I know that cause he and I did a bunch of stuff together, you know, from the time we met and, you know, until he passed away. But, you know, what we realized is that as we got to talking that both of us had more in common with each other than either of us had with anyone in the department. You know, the department was a kind of classic, you know, Anglo-African department, so very analytic. You know, some good people there. Henry Odero Aruka was there. Anyone in African philosophy knows him as the founder of the Sage Philosophy Project. A bunch of other good people there. But Emmanuel and I kind of spoke the same language in a certain sense. He was a Nigerian philosopher. And so after, you know, I was still in Canada at that time. And after I came back, he sends me this note and says, hey, I'm doing this book, this collection on post-colonial African philosophy. Do you want to contribute a chapter? And I said, are you nuts, guy? I mean, look at me. I'm, you know, I'm the white Canadian who has no background in this. Why would you think I would be able to contribute anything to this? And wouldn't it be presumptuous of me to do that? And we got to talking and really he was the one that said, no, there is a way for you to engage this too. Right. In other words, it's not just about where you were born. It's about what kind of questions interest you, what kind of space are you willing to work in? And he was the one that convinced me that, yeah, actually there is a place for someone like me to be part of that conversation. I can tell you what that place is not. That place is not me trying to represent Africa. Right. Mm-hmm. In other words, I can't lay any claim to being African, to have any, you know, I'm not part of the African diaspora. I've had my DNA done, as far as I can tell, no connection whatsoever, except, you know, millions of years ago. You know, culturally, that is not my culture, but that in and of itself doesn't mean that there can't be fruitful conversation. What it means is that I have to listen to what people are saying who are from that space, ask the right questions, figure out what the right questions are, and then try and figure out how that connects to things in my own background. And right. That has been, you know, in my experience, at least a pretty fruitful way to go about it. You know, so I don't identify as an African philosopher. I'm not African, but I do, you know, teach and write within African philosophy.
Right. Yeah, it was maybe 4 years ago when I started, for reasons I won't bore people with, really discovering Buddhist philosophy in India and Taoist philosophy in China. So mm-hmm. I was reading Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti, Chuang Tzu. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what your experience was finding African philosophy, but I found it was hard for me to read it, not just because the arguments could be very intense, but because it seemed to me that there was something I was missing.
Right.
And I couldn't quite put my finger on it.
Right.
And then when I really researched, I had to research Western writers who were fluent in Indian philosophy to kind of right. bring it. And basically they said, there are certain assumptions that Chandrakirti, Nagarjuna, et cetera, are coming to that you don't have.
Right.
Because you don't, you're from somewhere else with a different tradition.
Right.
So for instance, the idea that the self is kind of this essentialistic unitary thing, they don't have it.
Right.
The idea of free will, they don't have it.
Right.
The idea of a linear set causal story, right. they don't have it.
Right.
It was that in any way the sort of experience you had when coming into and discovering African philosophy?
Yeah, in part I would say it is, and in part no. And I think the part that's no is the difference of the traditions that we're talking about here. I mean, you know, the thinkers you're talking about exist in a very long textual tradition. They are embedded in it. They know it. They're responding to it. All of those sorts of things. Now there is a textual tradition in Africa too, but it's not the same kind of thing as India, as China, as Japan, as some of these places. And so, you know, you have to think differently about the tradition that's being drawn on there. And also, I guess, the history of colonialism, especially, that has shaped and in many ways warped how that tradition is actually engaged and approached within Africa. Hmm. I mean, there's a lot to rethink. I mean, when Ngugi wa Thiong'o talks about decolonizing the mind, he's not kidding, right? The mind really does have to be decolonized, you know, certainly for Westerners looking at Africa and also in many cases for Africans thinking about their own past.
Right.
You know, there is a set of assumptions about, you know, the relationship to the past, what it ought to be, you know, that once you start looking at that past, it doesn't necessarily line up with the kinds of questions that might be asked in the West about, you know, how you do those things. So, yes, so in answer to your question, there is a certain sense that there are some concepts, some assumptions that are not part of my world that I had to get familiar with, you know, especially working in somewhere like South Africa, where there's a recent history of apartheid, you know, there's a longer history of colonialism and settlers, you know, settler colonialism. But there's also, you know, ethnic and cultural difference. There's, you know, a strong Indian presence. There's, you know, just a kind of racial and cultural and ethnic mix that feels very different to me, at least, than what we have in the U.S. here.
And certainly what you'd have in Canada.
And certainly right. what I have in Canada, although Canada's an interesting case on this yeah. as well, because you know, some of the most multicultural cities in the world right now are Canadian cities. Right? I mean, you know, Vancouver, Toronto, and Montreal are incredibly multicultural. And, you know, the Canadian approach to what that actually means differs quite markedly, I think, from the American approach.
Interesting.
You know, there's, you know, you'll find, you know, Punjabi, you know, or Sikhs doing bhangras, you know, dances to hockey games. You know, and things like this, which, and this goes like viral, you know, this is not just, you know, like a little kind of thing off in the corner. I mean, there's a very strong sense that those cultural traditions are not just tolerated, they're welcomed, and you can play with them. And, you know, that's something I struggle to see often in the U.S.
Yeah, I guess just to go on a side note here, it's one of the things that bugs me about when you talk about integration in the U.S. and you talk about the history of demands for integration.
Right.
Integration has always either meant or cashed out to be you will accommodate to the dominant strategies and the dominant etiquettes and the dominant norms.
Yep.
Whereas maybe in Canada, I don't know about other places, it's more integration is more like mixing two substances together.
Yeah.
You can't keep them from intermingling unless it's like oil and water. But
yeah.
It always bugs me that Americans think about integration often quite that way.
Yeah. And, you know, Canada is not an idyllic place. I mean, you know, there are tensions at the edges of the things. You know, there are people who don't want it to be like that. And there is a long history of, I mean, you know, just recently, if you've been watching the news, there is the discovery of 215 young, you know, children's bodies discovered in a residential school in British Columbia. You know, one of these schools where you know, Native Canadian First Nations children would have been sent, essentially taken away from their family in order to, you know, inculcate them in the dominant way of thinking into, into the dominant language and all the rest of that. And they were dying by the scores. And it's just like, it's been an absolute shock to everyone except the Native Canadian people who've known this all along,
right.
You know?
Right.
And sure. So there's a real kind of reckoning happening in Canada now too. I mean, there's a history of racism there that is being dealt with too,
I think the point is that the racism in some sense manifests very differently in these different places. Like in a talk that I saw you give, you know, you talk about like the proverbial American who goes to South Africa to talk about racism.
Right.
And everyone just kind of looks at him funny because the terms he or she is using are not going to be the terms they're using and are not going to be the terms that Canadians are using, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's, I mean, Gilles Deleuze once said that all concepts are multiples, you know, and sometimes as philosophers, I think we want to make concepts into singular things. Like, here's the definition of this term race, right? But as soon as we start engaging in the world, we realize that it's not quite so simple. You know, in fact, there's, you know, I feel Wittgensteinian maybe at this point, but there are family resemblances between these concepts, but they're not all the same thing. The way Wittgenstein talks about games, you know, what is a game? Well, you know, there's no single thing that all games must have.
Well, it's not even multiple across different places. It's even multiple within the same place. Like I teach a course called Intro to Diversity in our College of Education. And one of the ways I try to show them that race is a quote unquote social construct, is the idea that no definition, that working definition that we have of race in the U.S. even makes sense to describe our situation.
Right.
So, you know, I ask them, what is race? And first of all, they say it has to do with some cluster of biological traits.
Right.
And then I'm like, well, but a lot of people say Clarence Thomas, the U.S. Supreme Court Justice, isn't black. But clearly he has those traits.
Right.
Well, then it's cultural. And they're, what they're saying is that he's not culturally black. I'm like, but Rachel Dolezal, the woman who kind of quote unquote passed.
Yeah.
People are saying she's white, so but she was culturally. And then they say, well, it must be something, you know, like historical. And it's like, but there's no single history of how race evolved in the U.S. So that doesn't work. It's I guess it's even multiple in a lot of ways.
It is. And, maybe this is something we can learn from the pragmatist thinkers, but maybe it's the work that the concept does for us that we might want to focus on as opposed to its intentional definition or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's think then about going back to African philosophy. I'm going to ask what I know is a really large question, and it may even be a little bit of an awkward question. But if you think about kind of what we know of as philosophy, what we think of as philosophy in the West, so to speak, with big quotation marks around the West.
Right.
What are some of the areas of continuity and discontinuity or similarity and dissimilarity in African philosophy to that?
Right. Well, so, you know, if you were to look at kind of introductory textbooks of African philosophy, what you would often find are familiar categories, right? You would find, you know, somebody talking about metaphysics, somebody talking about epistemology, ethics, you know, these sorts of things. And that might lead one to believe that those categories have already been established. You know, we know about them in the West. And now what we're looking for is the African variation or the African kind of flavoring of those concepts. And so let's take epistemology, for example. You know, there's an African philosopher named Kwasi Wiredu who had this notion that truth is opinion. Okay. And so, and Wiredu was a very good philosopher. He actually taught for years at University of South Florida, just down the road from me. And you know, if you just look at that little phrase, truth is opinion, that comes off as if it's just, you know, well, over here, we think that truth is not just opinion in the West, because opinion isn't good enough to actually verify and all of that, you know, true justified belief and all of that stuff. And here's this guy in Africa saying, well, no, it actually is opinion. And we could leave it at that level, but to do that would be to lose what Wiredu is actually trying to say, which is to really root the question of truth within a kind of cultural context. In other words, not abstract it out and say culture just doesn't matter at all. And that's often what I find in African philosophy. On a superficial level, it looks like, oh yeah, there's a you know, opinion about personhood. There's an opinion about, you know, the structures of state, what justice is, you know, what the good is, you know, I mean, any of these sorts of things. And so it very comfortably can kind of slide into, you know, a kind of worldwide conversation of philosophy. I think that's actually a problem. Okay. And I think it's a problem in part because it doesn't ask questions about those structures to begin with. Right. I mean, it leaves them in place and says, you know, we in the West figured out what philosophy is. Now let's check and see what we can find in the rest of the world that may fit those categories.
Right. And then that leads you to kind of the temptation to ignore how they got there. And that, again, would lead to what they mean by that, which may be peculiar, given, like, if you just look at it in reference to, oh, he's just a mini Protagoras.
Right. Well, you know, and for Africa, it gets worse in that, you know, there's a long history of Western racism in philosophy towards Africa. Hegel famously said that Africans were not capable of having an intellectual life, essentially. You know, and so much of the task of African philosophy, I would say, since the mid 20th century, has been to try and rebut that rejection, to try and say, yes, we do have a place. The way I think of it is as you know, carving out a space on the map of philosophy, right? There is a space for Africa.
So does that mean, because when I read Emmanuel Eze's book on reason, which again is a really remarkable book, he was seemed almost self-consciously to invoke probably mostly Western philosophers. He engaged in mostly Western philosophical conversation. Now that could have been because he was maybe writing from the US. It sounds like he taught in the US for a bit. I don't know. I wonder if that's part of kind of what you're saying, is it's almost like, have Africans felt like they've needed to justify African philosophy by reference to European work?
Overwhelmingly, I think that's been the case. Actually, I think Emmanuel's doing something more interesting. You're right, by the way, that Emmanuel did his PhD at Fordham University. He taught at Bucknell University in Pennsylvania for a long time, and then went to DePaul in Chicago. So in his book on reason, you know, here's the background of that kind of conversation. A lot of times when people have talked about the question of reason when it comes up for Africans, the question is, A, do they have it? Right? Do they have rationality? And I'm going to use those terms differently.
Reason. And we assume there's an it. There's a singular it.
We assume that exactly. And if they have it, what does it look like? Like, is there a uniquely African way of thinking about this? Mm. And part of that history has to be the history of things like negritude. Negritude is this kind of a movement around the time of the Harlem Renaissance in the U.S. So that's the time period we're talking about. But it was very much focused both in Paris and France, and also in the Francophone Caribbean. So people like Leopold Sédar Senghor, who eventually became the president of Senegal, was part of this. Amy Césaire was part of it. Leon Damas, many others. And that movement was read as a kind of answer back to the question about rationality. The answer basically was, The West has what we call discursive rationality, that is logic and deduction. Mm-hmm. Africa has emotional rationality. And so there was that attempt to say, yes, Africa has a rationality, but it's just not like European rationality. And now that position has come under serious criticism when it's put that in those terms, right? And justifiably so, right? I mean, to say that Africa has this, I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, trying to account for, you know, within feminism, women's, you know, approach to rationality as being a fundamentally different, you know, thing than men's approach, which essentially cuts right. off women from this whole other, you know.
And it essentializes, it also essentializes.
Exactly. Now, so that background you need to understand going to Emmanuel's book, because Emmanuel starts to think about categories of reason. He uses categories like phenomenological reason.
Hermeneutical reason.
Exactly. And he ends up with what he calls ordinary reason. Okay. And what's notable about that is that none of those have a kind of cultural kind of index to them. In other words, it's not that, you know, those forms of reason are you know, located in a specific geographical place. What he means is that we all have all of those, but mm-hmm. in different ways. And rationality is our way of putting all that together. Right.
Right. So the way I'm going to make sense of a mathematical proof, yes. the reason through a mathematical proof is different than the way I'm going to interpret what I think a poem means.
Absolutely.
Which is different than what I'm going to do when I'm putting together an IKEA table.
Exactly. And it's different from what you're going to do when you think about your relation to the community and what the community desires
right.
versus your own individual, you know, desires. Right. So he wants to kind of have that vector as well. Like reason is not just what goes on up here in your head. Reason is distributed into a world of other reasonable people. So, right. so what he's giving us is essentially a model of rationality in which he can say, we all have all of this stuff. Now the question is, in a particular place, how are these things weighed and how are they deployed in specific kinds of circumstances? Which is, I think, way more interesting, actually.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, the main point of his book, and there's a reason we're talking about his book so much, because I think it gets us into kind of what your concerns are. It's the main point of his book is almost, let me know if I'm wrong here, but is to say the idea, thinking about reason as it's like this disembodied thing that we tap into, is wrong. It
right.
reason is always embodied. It's always in some sense perspectival with a purpose.
Yep.
And to ignore those things, the embodiment, the purpose that you have for it,
right,
is to fail to understand the diversity that it inevitably creates.
Right. Yeah.
Like he's saying, it basically to think means you're going to produce diversity.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
And the reason is because of the embodiment and perspectivalness.
Exactly. And that's, you know, I think sometimes in philosophy, we have thought that reason kind of narrows us down to a singular sort of goal of some sort. And we get that from, you know, we imagine that's what Socrates was doing in the Socratic dialogues, right? You know, we start out here at the beginning of a dialogue where, you know, somebody has an opinion about piety or justice or this or that. And Socrates kind of goes through to the Elenchus, you know, the kind of place where, you know, they try all of the, you know, variations on that only to realize that none of them work. And the person finally says, well, now I'm stung like a stingray and I don't know where to go. And then they can begin and they kind of build something up and it feels very teleological, right? It feels like now we're working towards the real thing, which we can all agree on. And so that's the image we get. And yet also in Plato, you know, in the Timaeus, we have Socrates, you know, talking about the chora, right? You know, that kind of the birthing space of concepts, essentially, of reason. And, you know, so we get this incredible diversity, you know, reflected in this, in the Timaeus that feels like it stands in some tension to what's yeah. going on in a lot of the other dialogues.
Well,
so
I know there's all yeah.
that stuff.
I mean, I know there's some interesting discussions about whether or not we should call Plato a sophist.
Right.
And some of his dialogues do come off as
right.
sophistical in the sense, especially none of them seem to resolve.
right.
Right. Like, so maybe that's just a function of dialogue. But you're right. I mean, he didn't ask, like, you know, well, why do you think that?
Right.
What is he? It's almost like there is a right answer. We're trying to figure out what it is. You gave an answer that doesn't seem correct.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas he could have said, well, why do you think that? Like, what is, give me the backstory.
Yeah.
And why you think that way.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, and going back to African philosophy and all of this, I think there is a certain sense of what philosophy's tasks actually are, what philosophy's task is or could be. That was kind of covered over during the times of colonialism when, you know, within Africa, you know, many people were taught this is what it means to do philosophy. It means to answer these very specific questions, which is to produce these concepts that are not tied back into reality in a very kind of close manner. So, you know, I have had the sense that, you know, instead of thinking about, you know, there's kind of a question that I think has been behind a lot of African philosophy over its development since the mid 20th century. And that is the question of, is there an African philosophy? And I take that to be a question which is not African. I take that to be an outside question. Prove to me that there's
an African philosophy. You're taking it to be, there's this thing we know of as philosophy. Let's look at Africa and see if they have something that looks like it.
And in order to answer that question, you know, is there an African philosophy, you have to do two things. Number one, you have to show me something that's really philosophy. In other words, not religion, not folk tales, not all of that other stuff, but really philosophy. Number two, you have to show me something that's really African, right? In other words, not derived from somewhere else and not kind of something warmed over, you know, from Oxford or you know, Frankfurt or whatever.
Yeah.
And so that's an almost impossible ask.
I see, yeah, I smell, I guess, if you will, if you'll permit it, a no true African philosophy, right? Or a no true African fallacy, which is that if there's nothing that looks like English philosophy or European philosophy, we'll say, see, there's no philosophy. Right. If there is something that looks like European philosophy, we'll say, well, see, they're not really doing African philosophy. They're doing European philosophy.
Damned if you don't. Exactly. And so, you know, that's why I consider that actually to be an illegitimate question. And so in my first book, you know, I basically tried to say, here's a better question. What is it to do philosophy in this African place? Right. And so I tried to work out a theory of place, which tied philosophy to its places without making it simply into anthropology or sociology or literature or politics or something like that.
Do you need a working idea of what philosophy is, though, to ask that question?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think at least you have to have a sense that philosophy has a history of methods, a history of applications. I mean, there's a recent book that just came out called Thought, A Philosophical History. I think it was even this 2021 book. And I think it's really interesting. I mean, it doesn't have a chapter on what I, you know, the version that I would think, but still what it's done, I think, really usefully is to say philosophy is not a singular thing either. Right. It's not just the defense of a set of propositions that we recognize in a certain kind of way with arguments that we recognize as being legitimate. And once we do that, we hold concepts in our mind or we hold propositions in our mind. And that's what philosophy is. Right. That's only one way of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I know that Julian Baggini has a more popularized book called How the World Thinks, which I will confess I did read a little bit of just in preparation for thinking about this dialogue. And one of the things that struck me that I think relates to what you're saying is he says, I mean, in the Muslim world, the distinction between philosophy and theology doesn't make sense.
Right.
doesn't make sense. And if you come in asking, is this religion, theology, or is this philosophy, you're just going to fail to understand.
Yeah.
It's a unique project.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think he's absolutely right about that. You know, and we could even take that a step further. You don't have to agree with somebody's conclusion on something or somebody's belief about something in order to recognize it as philosophically interesting and useful and creative. So, you know, the example I use is, Western medieval thinking. So, you know, you look at someone like Augustine, who, among other things, is working out a theory of personhood. And how is he doing it? He's doing it in the context of the Trinity. Well, you don't have to believe that there is a Trinity or even believe that there's a God to recognize that there's philosophical work being done. And, you know, that, you know, his notion of personhood is about a projection and a relation, not about an intention. you know, and so the three persons of the divine Trinity are persons, not substances. And that starts us down a path, right? That starts us down a path of ways of thinking about the person, which are useful whether or not you buy the theological assumptions.
Right. So then let's get back to the question of that you reframed, which was, what does it mean to do philosophy in Africa? What does it mean to do philosophy as an African?
Right. In this place, and I want to use the word place in that, because I think a lot turns on that.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about that then. Because you don't mean by place simply like I'm in Greenville, North Carolina.
Right.
That's place. That you mean a lot of things. That technically are kind of bundled together by place. So let's talk about that. What are the things that we mean?
Well, so place does have, you know, a lot of philosophical work done on it over the last several decades. Some of it's in the phenomenological tradition, coming out of Heidegger especially. You know, people like Edward Casey have done work on this, Jeffrey Malpass, you know, me, others. And so what we're talking about is not just place's location. Okay, that's just one kind of fairly abstract notion of what we mean by place. What we mean is really a kind of form of what I'll call inhabitation, or ways of existing and interacting, bounded by geography, bounded by materiality, embodiment. All of those sorts of things that certain kinds of things possible.
Right. So if you were, if you're doing philosophy as someone who's deaf,
right,
that could affect the kind of the place you're doing philosophy from.
Absolutely. And that's actually a great example because, you know, that's a feature of relations, right? It's a feature of language, essentially. It's not, you know, and so I would want to read that into place as well, because as soon as we have those sets of relations, we do what I call scaffold around them, right? So, you know, if you're deaf, you know, in some cultures you might get some support from the wider culture for deaf people. You might have, you know, crosswalk signals that, you know, alert both deaf and blind people in different kinds of ways. Most of the time, cultures scaffold for the majority, right? And so you as a deaf person are going to have to figure out ways to build your society so you can do what you do. And that becomes a place. I mean, that becomes your inhabitation.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, your social positionality as well. I mean, here's one thing that always bugs me about the way most people think about philosophy. You have an author who writes a book.
Right.
They give you the argument. They say a lot of times things like X is, you know, a reasonable objection would be X, or X is justified by.
Right.
And what they're doing is appealing to an audience. Those are terms that only make sense if you're appealing to an audience.
Right.
But we very seldom ask, who is the audience that's going to think that X is justified by? Who is the audience that's going to share the assumptions of this philosopher? Like, the example that I always think of is Robert Nozick's book, Anarchy, State, and Utopia, mm-hmm. where in the first paragraph, he makes a humongous assumption, which is that people have natural rights that other people can't violate, and that one of those rights is self-ownership.
Right.
And it's a huge assumption. He doesn't treat it as problematic because he assumes, maybe rightly, that most of his audience is coming from within a tradition where they either agree with that assumption,
right,
or they see that it's a quote unquote reasonable assumption to have, which obviously opens up, what is your conception of reasonable you're dealing with? Why is that within the bounds of reasonableness? Yeah. So sorry for the ramble, but that's something that I've noticed more and more every time now that I hear words like is reasonable to assume, or it just sets my ears off because I'm thinking, okay, who's the audience that you're, because clearly there will be an audience for which that is not reasonable.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, you know, that's, and the Nozick example is a great example of that, you know, and I think when I started engaging African philosophy, I started having to be much more aware of the question of audience. I mean, you know, I was always aware of it to some extent, but what do I as a white Canadian say in a room full of, you know, Africans, some of whom are black, some, you know, pretty much all of whom grew up in the place that I am, you know? And am I going to try and make a claim that is really for an audience of white North Americans? Because they're going to look at me, you know, and say, I know where you think you are. You know, one of the examples, I was in Kenya once, and a black American, an African American philosopher came through, did a lecture, great lecture, but he started off the lecture, and he said, you know, I am African American. I know that means that I'm basically American, but there are aspects of Africa that resonate for me. And he said, and one of those is drumming, and the whole room burst out laughing. Because in Kenya, I mean, unlike West Africa, many places in West Africa, in Kenya, you know, yeah, there's drums, but they're used just to keep time for, you know, a choir singing or something like that. There's not the polyrhythmic, you know, tradition of drumming that you would have in Nigeria and places like that. And so he, you know, he was surprised at the, you know, at the response that happened in the room. And it was, you know, a kind of crystal clear example to me of speaking to a different audience. Right.
And then not realizing that.
And then not realizing. And he had every right to resonate with that. But that was a resonating that was actually for a different part of Africa, not for Kenya.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things you said before we started recording was that going back to the idea that you know, concepts are multiples, when you have such cross-cultural misunderstandings, it's, in some sense, I don't remember how you said it, but it's sort of an opportunity for philosophy itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Misunderstanding is an opportunity for philosophy if you are willing to take it. Right.
So in a case like that, it's an opportunity to say, well, what are the assumptions that I've come in with? Why did I come in with those assumptions? Not that it's bad to come in with assumptions. No. It's probably unavoidable to come in with.
Totally unavoidable.
Bounded assumptions.
Yeah.
But like, we don't usually realize how bounded our assumptions are and how affected by place those assumptions are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, one of my favorite examples is the concept of race, which, you know, I mean, I tell my students sometimes you can be black in the US, white in Brazil, and colored in South Africa and be exactly the same person, right?
Yeah.
What's changed? Well, not you, right? It's the deployment of the concept of race, right?
Yeah. I don't know if you've read, there's a memoir that I really love by Thomas Chatterton Williams. It's called Unlearning Race. Hmm. And he talks about, it was born by him being, I guess, quote unquote, multiracial, although he would hate the term.
Right.
And having children with a white woman that effectively look white and they live in France.
Right.
And one of the objections that's always given to him is, because his idea is we need to really start questioning what these concepts can and can't do, because they can't explain my children.
Yes. Yes.
And they can't explain my relation to my children.
Yes.
So one of the objections always is, well, that's well and good, but people are going to see you as black. And then his response to your point is to say, well, if I'm going by what people see me as, then am I Arab when I'm in a French airport?
Yeah.
Right. Because French airports always see me as Arab.
Right.
I'm light enough skinned where I'm seen as Arab.
Right.
Does that mean that I'm Arab?
Right. Right.
No, it means that race is local. And he uses the term race is local all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, those are really important ways of nuancing the concept. I mean, the concept is not going to go away, but we have what I call scaffolded around it, right? So we've built institutions and curricula and practices and language and all sorts of things around a concept like this so that it does a particular kind of work and doesn't do other kinds of work. And as soon as you do that, you get those places where it doesn't exactly fit, just as he describes, right? You know, me and my family don't fit into these scaffolded categories. You know, I mean, for me, the thing that makes me, I guess, aware of how important that institutionalization of concepts is when you think about concepts that have not been institutionalized in the same way. So the one I often think about is handedness, right? So being right-handed or being left-handed, right? So if you think about it, that's that has its roots in biology. It has its roots in language as well. I mean, you know, the Latin for right-handed is dexterous, right? There's our English word, which is a good thing. Mm. You know the Latin for left-handed?
No.
Sinister.
Oh, okay.
Right? So there's very clear coding within language that one of these is better than the other. You know, we have scaffolded our society so that it privileges the 90% of people who are right-handed. And people who are left-handed have, you know, a harder time of it. And they could tell you,
I can attest.
You're left-handed?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm right-handed, right? So you know, like can openers don't really work and all the rest of it, right?
I was just as a side story to illustrate buttress the point. I was putting a sleep sack on our one-year-old last night.
Right.
And the zipper comes from the top. It goes down to the bottom. And I had to make 6 passes at it for it to, it wouldn't lock correctly. So at the top, you could pull the top open. Yeah. It didn't interlock correctly. Yeah. Whereas I tell my wife that I like these sleeps, I'm having a problem putting these on. And she's like, what do you mean? They just like, literally you just start from the top and go down.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Now, right. Really, so no. It's obviously it's built for under the assumption right. that 90% of users will be right-handed.
Exactly. Notice what we have not done with handedness, right? We have not, we don't have movements around it. We don't have people marching in the street. We don't have, people passing, you know, we don't have institutes of handedness studies. We don't have journals. We don't have, all of the rest of that stuff. Now, could we? Yeah, sure. We could have. I mean,
actually, historically, the historical contingency is that we absolutely could have.
Right. Exactly.
We decided culturally, for reasons that I don't begin to understand, to loosen up on the idea of handedness throughout school and throughout training. But had we not done that,
right?
That could have been.
Yeah.
You know, left-handed lives matter.
There were forms of oppression, you know, teachers whacking students' knuckles when they used the wrong hand for writing and things like that. So, you know, yeah, all sorts of ways in which a minority of society was essentially discriminated against. But we do not have the things that we have for race or for gender or things like that. And for me, what that tells me is that, you know, I mean, the kind of short phrase that I have for this is the investment you make is the freedom you make, right? So if we invest in race, if we invest in gender, if we invest in ability-disability questions, if we invest in these sorts of things, we're doing two things. We are opening that space up for the expression in that area, mm-hmm. and we're also providing the opportunity for domination and oppression to happen as well.
Yeah.
So simultaneously, for race, you know, I mean, Deleuze talks about 1,000 tiny genders. I like to talk about 1,000 tiny races, you know.
Yeah.
We could have the possibility for all of this kind of racial expression, which is wonderful and brilliant and all of that. And we also have the possibility of it being captured and used for white supremacy to dominate everyone who's not white.
It's a very also Foucaultian, Butlerian point. I always like to mention, I feel like Judith Butler is often misunderstood as saying, mm-hmm. let's abolish these gender categories. And I think she makes quite clear that she's just saying, look, whenever you have gender categories, you have exclusion. It's just there. It's by nature.
You have it.
Yeah. That's not to say you can wipe out gender categories, but you can at least call them into question.
Sure. Well, and that's, you know, the whole discussion around queering gender and queering pretty much anything is, you know, a move away from binaries as if, you know, there's this and that and nothing else, and seeing a wide range of expression, and then doing that questioning that you just referred to, right?
Right. So then going back to African philosophy, it seems like looking at African philosophy as a Western person who's familiar with the Western traditions is in some ways a way to kind of queer philosophy, in the sense that you can see how different this thing can be done from a place that has a markedly different history, a markedly different place.
Right.
So then let's go back to the question that we had before, which we still haven't really quite looked at yet, which is your question of what does it mean to philosophize, or what does it mean to do philosophy, from Africa in Africa as an African,
right?
As different from what it would mean
right
in Europe.
So, the part that we haven't talked about is a function of philosophy, which I think often gets overlooked. And I've used the term already. It's creating concepts. Okay. So we often think about philosophy as something that analyzes or describes, right? So let's describe the world we're in. Let's describe the metaphysics. Let's describe this or whatever. If we reoriented it towards the idea that philosophy is there to create a concept that allows us to be human, right? Mm-hmm. So in other words, moving it over from being to becoming, like, what does it mean to become, you know, African? What does it mean to become human in a space?
Yeah.
And so for me, the answer to what is it to do philosophy in this African place amounts to, what does it mean to create concepts based on the heritage that you have, based on the cultural richness, based on all of that, but also based on your present, also based on the world in which you find yourself? What concepts are adequate for you to theorize that space, but not just theorize it, but also flourish within it as well. Mm.
Which doesn't exclude analysis of concept.
No, not at all.
It just adds to it.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I mean, I think this is the part of philosophy that often gets overlooked. And for me, what it means is a move. This is maybe the most controversial part of the way I think about all of this. We think about propositions in philosophy as being the gold standard, right? You know, if I have a proposition that's been argued for, then now that's the content of my mind. You know, I have it here. And, you know, it's almost like that, you know, property claim, you know, liberal property claim, you know, this is my property now. And, you know, it's not exclusive to me. And I want to convince you that my claim is, you know, that this thing is the right way to look at something. But every claim, every proposition comes as a result of a question. And I want to reorient philosophy to its questions, to the well-asked questions, to ask, what does it mean to ask a question well? What does it mean to ask a question that opens up a new space of thought? Mm-hmm. Right. So Gaston Bachelard talked about this in the context of science. He talked about the problematique, you know, the problematic, which was a question that can open up a new way of thinking. His idea was in science, like we're going down a particular road of explanation, and now somebody asks a new question. Einstein comes along and says, no, Newton's not wrong. It's just that he's provincial, right? He doesn't think about the very large or the very small, the very fast. You know, he's not adequate for that. He's adequate for a certain kind of thing. So now let's re-ask the question. Now that's interesting, right? Because now we've got all sorts of other stuff that can be done within that new space of thought. Right. And,
could you make sense of that almost as saying like, Kuhn's idea of normal science versus revolutionary science. Normal science is when questions are piled on top of the previous questions, right, and they're piled on top and they're supported by the previous questions.
Right.
So each question gets narrower and narrower.
Right.
Whereas
right.
the revolutionary science questions would be the questions that disrupt the assumptions of the questions that normal science just doesn't ask.
Yeah. Yeah. And there is a Kuhnian sensibility to this. I mean, Bachelard was writing, you know, roughly the same time. And focusing on the idea that questions could be, I mean, actually Althusser comes along and takes Bachelard's idea and calls it epistemic rupture. And what he's interested in is that Marxist notion that there is a break, you know, with capitalist, ways of thinking. And what does it take to make that break, right? So along the same lines as what you're describing with Kuhn as well, I think there's this, you know, what does it mean to kind of take a turn to see that the questions that led you here maybe were necessary, but they've exhausted the space in which they were, exploring. Now we need a new space.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I also say that because, again, my experience with Taoist and Buddhist philosophy, I think the only way I was able to make sense of what they were doing is to say they're asking different questions, which lead them to different ideas,
right,
which lead them to different questions. So they're literally walking in some sense a different path.
Right.
And if I think of them as just a partner of the path that I'm used to thinking about walking,
right,
I'm just not going to understand it.
Right.
So I have to go back and strip away a whole bunch of things that I'm used to thinking,
so
which is fascinating.
Which is amazing. Yeah. And, you know, there's a, I don't even know what to call her, Mika Ball, who is hugely important and for so many reasons. She's a Dutch, do I call her a philosopher? I don't know. Her background is in theology, but she's very important in narratology, in art history, in all sorts of things. Anyway, she wrote this book called Traveling Concepts in the Humanities, a rough guide. And the point of the book was to ask what happens when a concept from one area that has been developed within one space gets moved over to another space. What happens when the concept of evolution, you know, developed as an explanation in one space gets moved over to, let's say, economics or, you know, something else? Well, there's a violence done, right? I mean, it doesn't exactly fit. But that violence could be a creative moment, right? I mean, you know, we see this all the time going across disciplines. And this is the kind of thing I'm arguing for within going across cultures as well. Like, I want to preserve the idea that misunderstanding is actually a potentiality for creativity, not just a failure, not just a failure and something that somebody has to be embarrassed about.
Right. So maybe we should go then into, you mentioned much earlier in the conversation that one of the things that that I guess is a common theme within African philosophy is the idea of dealing with colonialism and the kind of what colonialism has done, and in some sense what, I don't know if I should say what the place is we are theorizing from,
right?
In the sense that, are we African? Are we French? You know, like, how much do we owe to France? How much do we owe to Nigeria, et cetera? So what is, in some ways, I don't want to say what is the impact of colonialism on African philosophy, but how does African philosophy's thinking about colonialism manifest?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a huge question. I mean, I think there are some people that have done very extensive work on that. Achille Mbembe, for example, wrote a book about 20 years ago now called On the Post-Colony, where he worked through some of those questions. You know, the colonialism could be looked at in a couple of different ways in Africa. I mean, it absolutely is a system of domination. A system of resource exploitation, of the basis for slavery, the basis for apartheid, all of those things.
Yeah.
Right. It's also an encounter of cultures with each other. Okay. And so I want to hold both of those things at the same time, right? Because, I think there's a certain danger in trying to deny the past, and I don't know that, you know, anyone's really trying to deny the past, but there is a certain sense in some people's minds that we could go before colonialism.
So Frantz Fanon's idea, it was one of the later books that he wrote, of like, the idea is that we should shed all remnants of kind of colonialist of the values of the colonizer, as if we could get back to what we were before.
Yeah. You know, and I see that sometimes too with, when people are rethinking curricula within African philosophy departments. I mean, often Fanon and Stephen Bantu Biko are seen as, you know, let's just read these guys and like, forget about anyone else. And that's fine until you ask who those guys read. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, both Fanon and Biko were extremely well versed within the European tradition. Biko was constantly going back and forth with the American Civil Rights Movement. He was reading Malcolm X. He was reading, King. He was reading all of these people. In other words, there was a cultural exchange happening. And so I think what we have to look at is, what are the implications of the cultural encounter? What exactly did the encounter of colonialism do to Africa? And in my mind, what it did was it supplanted African questions with non-African questions, right? It said, you know, you think you know how to conduct your communities. Well, let us tell you how to integrate into a world economy. You think you know how to build a state. Let us tell you how to really build a state. I mean, every time one of those things is brought in and simply imposed on Africa, what you have is not a real conversation between cultures. You have a moment of violence, right? You have a moment of denying the questions and the history that was happening there in favor of, you know, what someone thought was the right way to do something. And so that has to be, you know, unspooled in a certain sense, at least enough to ask, what questions should we be asking? Okay. You know, we can't just pretend that Africa doesn't have countries, right? I mean, some people would like to do that, right? But, you know, a lot of those countries are colonial constructs. Right. So what does it mean to think as African within those colonial constructs instead of saying, what would it mean to get rid of all the colonial constructs, right? Because I think that's not realistic. Now, again, I'm speaking this as not a non-African, right?
Right.
Africans may well disagree with me on that, and that would be, I would love to hear, you know, how they would think through getting rid of those colonial constructs. But I think you get rid of some, but you try and get rid of some, but you can't get rid of them all, right? So you have to go forward from where you are as opposed to recover what you imagine, you know, things were like before that encounter happened.
Right. So then let's see. So a few things occur to me. If we put the importance of philosophy on place, first of all, I don't know if you know anything about the history of why, and I don't know if this is only the Western tradition or traditions, why did we ever act as if you could do placeless philosophy? Right? Because again, going back to my issue with quote unquote is justified.
Yeah.
It's like we're saying it as if you're not talking to an audience. This is just like you're there's this justification standard just hanging up there in the air and you've happened to hit it.
Right.
But so.
Yeah. No, actually, the long answer to that is in Edward Casey's book, The Fate of Place. What Casey does in that book is really to look at how we addressed questions of place in the, and he focuses on the West. In ancient times, and then that discussion was essentially lost coming into modernity. And so he charts the loss of that question and the recovery of that question into the 20th century. So he really tells that story actually really well.
Is it the coevolution with Western science? Because I know Western science always aspired to a sort of objectivity. So I don't know if Western science borrowed from a previous aspiration or if it.
There's a certain irony in that. I mean, I often say, Western thought thinks of itself as placeless or as aspiring to placelessness. But if you look at the development of any concept, and let's use scientific method as an example, right? You look at the development of scientific method, you have British empiricism, French rationalism, Polish logic, German, Weltanschauung, Leben's philosophy. I mean, you have all of these things coming together from their places, having to negotiate their boundaries through the 19th century until we come up with something that now we call scientific method. It was totally place-based the whole time. Yeah. It was all a conversation. And you could take any concept like that in the European tradition and what we now think of as this abstract thing, you know, it all was happening in a place. And so, you know, part of what I'm trying to do here is to say, you know, this place stuff that I'm talking about in Africa, actually, it's relevant everywhere. Right.
Right. Right. It's not just that African philosophy has a place, but European philosophy is kind of a universal. It's that European philosophy is as place based. I mean, I imagine, especially if you look at it from Africa.
Right.
It's like, oh, that's entirely, you know. Right. Place-based. They're like you said, they're dealing with non-African questions.
Right.
Almost necessarily.
Yeah.
Just as we're dealing with maybe non-European questions. Yeah. So then sorry, you were gonna say something.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
So that brings me to a kind of a concern that I have. Because I definitely agree that all philosophy has to be done from a place and we need to be aware that it's done from a place. But if that's so, doesn't that sort of legitimate the idea of the ad hominem, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that I can evaluate your argument by looking at your positionality.
Right.
Whereas I guess, you know, at least in kind of the informal logic, that's called a fallacy of irrelevance.
Right.
And maybe it's not irrelevant.
Right.
But you can understand that it is changing the subject.
Yeah, absolutely. It is, I think it still is an irrelevancy, right? You know, because I think we are not reducible to a singular place, right? I mean, you know, let's think about Africa again. You know, somebody working in South Africa is probably has several languages, probably is, thinks of themselves as part of a particular community, maybe an Afrikaans community or a Zulu or whatever community, but also may think of themselves as Southern African, maybe think of themselves as African in general. So as soon as you start doing that, I think the ad hominem gets harder to, maintain because none of us are singular things. You know, I think feminist philosophy makes this point as well. to make the claim that, oh, you think that just because you're a woman, fails to understand the complexity of the kinds of engagement, the kinds of places that women find themselves in, right? You know, in the public sphere, in the private sphere, in relationally, all sorts of other things. And so, you know, I would resist that kind of reductionism, because I don't think it tells us much to say, oh, you just think that because you are X person.
But there is, right. So it seems like there's a balance, maybe, like, the ad hominem fallacy is a reduction of the argument to the identity, whereas maybe the balance is doing what someone like Charles Mills does when he evaluates John Rawls's argument and says, look, part of your argument and the fact that you ignore non-ideal questions about race in your contract is possibly because you're a white male who's never really had to think as a black male might.
Yeah.
But we can still evaluate your argument. It's not that we're saying let's tear up John Rawls because he's philosophizing from a privileged white male place.
Right.
It's saying let's just acknowledge when we look at his argument.
Right.
That there may be a blind spot here because he's theorizing as a white male who's never had to really deal with the realities of oppression.
Yeah, look, you know, we face that all the time in the thinkers that we are leveraging for, you know, for thought. I mean, Heidegger, for God's sake, you know, I mean, what do we do with him? You know, he had massive blind spots in his thought, and yet, you know, in 20th century thought, he's still really important, right? And, you know, so anyone working on Heidegger has to think through that. Is he reducible to, you know, the racism, the Nazi, you know, ties that he had? Is Derrida reducible to his relationship with Paul de Man? It's a very easy way to reject somebody, to say, oh, they're just that, and boom. You know, and within African philosophy, it's very easy to say, well, so-and-so is just part of this colonial, you know, way of thinking about things. There are people who say, I'm not reading any Hegel at all because of what Hegel thought about Africans. And it is, what Hegel thought about Africans was horrible, right? Let's not soft pedal it. It was awful. And it was not only awful in the sense that it's just like a random opinion that he had, he built it into his philosophy, right? I mean, it taints the whole thing, right? So, but what do you do with Hegel then? You know, there are African philosophers who are still taking Hegel seriously for a variety of reasons, you know, like the master-slave story, the, you know, other stuff. So, you know, these are all really complicated questions, and I would hope are the questions of further discussion, not simply, oh, we know who you are, boom, you're gone.
Right. And then I guess another question is, if we say that philosophy always comes from a place, that ideas and concepts always come from a place, does that in some sense mean that ultimately we're fated to disagreement on certain things because you just can't, right? It seems like the goal of the placeless philosophy was to say we can come to agreement,
right?
Because place doesn't really matter. It's ephemera.
Right.
The argument is really what matters. But, you know, what's always troubled me about that is like, to say is justified is to leave out, again, according to whom. Is justified to whom? Right. Different people are going to have different standards based on their different positionalities.
Right.
And obviously people dislike that partially because it means like we're just going to disagree. And my tendency is to say, okay.
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry that you thought otherwise. I'm sorry that you looked at this diverse world and thought that somehow we were just going to get there with a capital T.
Right.
And obviously people don't like that answer.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, it's when I think about those kinds of disagreements and the kind of, you know, the, if you wish, the positive aspiration of philosophy to kind of give us a way past disagreement, you know, I guess I have to look at its track record in being able to do that. And it's frankly not that great. And so I guess that's why I continue to invest in philosophy as a process, as opposed to a description of a method that has a specific goal to it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me, so let's suppose you and I disagree on something, you know, whatever, pick a concept. And you know, we are behaving as philosophers, right? Not as, let's say, psychologists, right? Where we might want to say, well, you believe that because of your childhood, and I believe this because of my environment, or, you know, something like that. In other words, you know, we're not reducing it to an aspect of our biographies or our histories. We are, in fact, saying it's the thought itself, it's the concepts itself that mean something because they come within a constellation of other concepts. And your background and my background are different enough that there's a bunch of other concepts clustered around these things that actually don't really coalesce with each other. So there's some of them do, some of them don't. So it looks like we're talking about the same thing. We're really not quite. Now it's an opportunity for exploration. Now it's an opportunity for me to say, hey, I think you're wrong about this. And you say, well, you think I'm wrong because you don't really understand that, you know, this concept matters to me and that concept, and I see these linked. And I start saying, okay, well, I never really had those as part of my way of thinking about this, but now I have to consider that. And so to me, that is the philosophical way of moving forward, right?
Yeah.
And maybe we will never come to agreement. And maybe that's not the point.
Right. Right.
Maybe we will have understood a little bit more about that space that can create something new, you know, between us.
Or maybe we come to agreement on certain things that we discuss, but that just introduces new disagreements ad infinitum, sort of thing. I mean, yeah, I can hear the critics saying like, oh yeah, but that just leads to the namby-pamby. You have your view, I have my view. Let's explain our views to each other. And then we'll realize that we can't really go any further than that. I don't think that's it either. I mean, it's not saying that we can't ever come to agreements. It's just saying that agreement isn't, we can't take it for granted.
Well, and I think there are things that we can, like, let's use something extreme like white supremacy in the US or something like that, right? I mean, is that just another position that somebody might hold and that's your view and I have a different view? No, I don't think so. And I think there are ways that we can say, you know, there are things which fundamentally misunderstand the space that we're in. They do not understand people's experience well, right? I mean, there are ways that we can get there without just making it into a totally relativist, you have your ideas and I have mine, right? I mean, I'm going to reject white supremacy, and I think there are good philosophical reasons for doing so.
Right. You know? Right. Yeah, I guess, lastly, I guess I'll just kind of trot out my theory about some of this, which is I really think that as someone who's not really as someone who I guess is warmer towards a relativist position than other people are, I think I told you this before the show. My suspicion is that philosophy as the idea of we'll just get to agreement somehow. If we, you know, like Habermas is probably the epitome of it.
Right.
Right. The idea that we can get there if we just try, I believe is motivated by a need to get peace or an end to problematic diversity.
Right.
Because if you look at how people speak about a position like either a relativist position or a position like that has the importance of place, like Eze's position is similar to that. Like we're just never going to agree on certain stuff and it's just inevitable. It's always talked about, not only argued against, but with a certain sort of language that evokes contempt.
Yeah.
Like we must avoid the snares of relativism.
Right.
Like, okay. So that obviously you're really trying to avoid something like that.
Right.
I just feel like it's motivated by this desire to like see a sort of peace or truce or end to problematic forms of disagreement.
You know, I mean, that kind of peace or truce feels coercive to me, though. You know, I mean, like, what did it take to get to that position of so-called agreement? I mean,
who was excluded?
Who was excluded? I mean, who is settled for something less than who they are in order to keep that peace? You know, I mean, I try not to think in terms of family metaphors with these things, but, you know, a family metaphor might be a good one on this. Like, you know, which kid has had to say, okay, I'll keep the peace by, you know, not speaking up, not complaining, not, you know, asserting what I really want, you know, because, you know, mom will get mad or my sister will get mad or somebody will get mad, you know, who paid the price for that peace?
Well, it's all over Rawls. I mean, if you, he's very clever in how he does it, right? You create rules of what a reasonable person is.
Right.
And then you say, well, these aren't exclusionary. These are like under, like we're excluding certain people for, but it ends up being circular because really what a reasonable person is someone who doesn't, who wouldn't go along with the contract.
Yeah. Well, that's why one reason I like Eze's book so much, because he broadens that discussion about what a reasonable person is, right? By layering a number of forms of reason and recognizing that, say, if we're talking about testimony or historical reason, it's different from talking about mathematical deduction, different from making moral arguments, different from all sorts of things. And we are all weighing different versions of those things, you know, in order to come to possible actions. You know, yeah. The other thing that wasn't mentioned, and we haven't really talked about 4E cognition much, but, you know, part of 4E cognition is what we call inactivism, which is the idea that sometimes our thoughts about the world do not precede our actions. Sometimes the actions precede our thoughts, right? In other words, we do something enough, and then that's the space in which a thought can be created, a concept can be arrived at. You know, and there's good basis for this within you know, cognitive science, right? I mean, that is in fact how we come to cognition often as well. And so I want to take some of those insights of an activism and put them within philosophy itself to say, you know, we don't just have a representational view of philosophy the way they did with cognition, that, you know, the project is to explain how we get these concepts in our head. You know, what we are is embodied beings in the world, within a social world, with technology and with all sorts of other things, in a world in which we are making stuff up on the fly. And, you know, and philosophy can live within that space too. It doesn't hover over it as if we have the mind of God.
Right. So any last things that, that we want to talk about in terms of African philosophy? What does it mean to philosophize African, et cetera?
You know, it's, I mean, we've kind of just gone over the surface really in some sense, because there are so many really rich areas in African philosophy. I mean, I am still working in the field because I think African philosophy has much to offer philosophy in general. You know, I think it feels to me like it's turning a corner from that project of defending the space of African philosophers, like we have a right to this space on the map, to saying, you know, we've convinced everyone that we're going to convince that there's an African philosophy. Now let's forget about convincing these people, and let's now create concepts out of our space that can contribute to the larger world of philosophy. And I feel like it's there. You know, it's just now. People are starting to do that.
That's a big corner to turn.
That's an exhilarating moment. I mean, I see that happening in the history of feminism too, right? You know,
right.
There was a moment at which the you know, a feminist philosopher said, you know, we've convinced everyone we're going to convince, right? That women are intellectual beings and are philosophers and all the rest of it. Now let's start creating concepts out of women's experience. And so we get care ethics. We get standpoint epistemology. We get, you know, all sorts of stuff that is really important within philosophy now, right? So,
Well, it was great talking to you.
Yeah.
I feel like we could probably go another hour.
Yeah, really.
And maybe we will, if enough people are interested in this, let us know what you think. But
yeah, no, it's my pleasure. It's been great.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, you bet.